Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. It is Wednesday, February 3rd. Thank you all for coming. We have two bills on our agenda today. We're going to hear just one of them, Senate Bill 1515. We're hoping to have a public hearing and a work session. We are going to go into greater detail about the bill in a moment, but we have some representatives here that need to get back to their committees on the other side of the building. So I will invite you all up. First, this is the big child welfare licensing bill that we discussed in November and January and in many of your offices. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 40.
Oh, wait. I have to open the public hearing.
Oh, sorry. I was so eager to get that.
Wow. That was close.
Minor details.
Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1515.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, also Chair of the Human Services and Housing Committee in the House. Really honored to be over here. I do have a health committee over there where we're actually voting and moving some bills. So just I'll be very brief. And first of all, thank you for the enormous amount of work that you've put into this incredibly important issue ever since I became a member of the Human Services Committee and then chaired it. How we take care of our most vulnerable citizens is really, really important, and I know you've really dug deep in this one. And I also want to really thank the vice chairs of my committee for their work on the strike force, I think you called it, the governor's advisory committee, external committee, which I know you're on as well. So a lot of attention to this. I do believe that we need to have more accountability, and I know you're going to have an opportunity to really dig into that here, and then we will have an opportunity. No, we won't have. I will have an opportunity as a member of the subcommittee, along with Representative Stark, to take another look at it afterwards. And so I'm eager to see what you all come up with. And I'm also eager to continue working with you to make sure that we build up the technical assistance capacity and get the reimbursement rate, which I recognize is very hard in a short session to get the reimbursement rate. But I know that it's very hard for these providers to actually do the right thing when they're paid at 70% of what it really costs. And so I'm very, very eager to take whatever steps we can to address it so that we're not only holding them accountable at the other end, but we're also supporting them to get there because we need to have really good quality spots. So looking forward to continuing to work with you. I know you care about that too. So thank you so much, and I'm sorry I have to run to Health Committee.
Thank you, Representative Kenny-Geyer.
Good afternoon. My name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50 in the great city of Gresham, and I am honored to be here today. I have to start with many of you know because I say it all the time, but I have an extensive law enforcement background, which is really where I first learned about child welfare, foster kids, those sorts of things. And, you know, my career started in the late 70s, so have seen some of the less than regulated, less than professional ways, especially some of our foster kids were treated and handled. And I had the great good fortune to spend some time with Senator Gelser on a trip to China and had many of a discussion to learn that some of those things have not been fixed yet. And that it is highly important for our most vulnerable population of children as they grow into adulthood to have the right role modeling, the right support, the right behaviors from those who have control over certain situations that we can never allow to happen again. So when I am here talking about this bill, and again, when I talk about law enforcement, where we have tons of regulations around tons of different things, the fact that mandatory licensing has to be regulated and required, it is sending a message that we need that correction, and we need it now, and we need it in place. We need it to be fair and accurate and providing a loving, welcoming environment for our young people to become successes. They have been discouraged in many sorts of ways by those who should never have had the opportunity to have that discouragement put upon them. So, again, which was a fabulous trip, broadened my horizons, helped me understand certain circumstances and certain things that we can, as legislators, legislate. It needs to happen. It needs to happen now. And my sincere admiration for Senator Gelser and what she's done, as well as each and every one of you that sit on this panel, because it is a collective thing to make these changes and these things happen. And again, it is important. I support the bill. and I hope everybody else does as well.
Thank you, Representative. Representative.
And I,
hello,
too, have a committee that's going now.
Bye. Thank you.
My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4, Southern Oregon. And my apologies if I need to cough. I might pull this away. In the last half an hour, I've suddenly developed a tickle in the throat that's causing me problems. So, you know, it seems like with every, you know, broad statement we make in life, that there's an exception. And this bill for me is an exception to a general policy that I don't like. In general, I don't like the concept of taking on major bills in a short session. This is an exception because I feel like we can't wait on something like this. And I feel like we've had a ton of time to vet this bill. Now, the final language still coming up, but the concepts, you know, as Representative Peluso mentioned, I was on the same trip with Senator Gelsert to China, and it was amazing how many times as this information and the public records were coming out, how many times we're all huddled around her cell phone reading the emails and dialoguing on this. So this conversation for me started back in October. And then Senator Gelsert, I appreciate it when you put forward, you know, your original concepts in November and allowed us to really kind of take a look at what you were thinking and the direction you were going as you dove into it. And I just admired the way that you've handled this, the way that you've basically been completely open on your thoughts, the way you've solicited information from stakeholders. And I feel like because of all the work you've done, this bill is the type of bill that would be an exception to the let's not do big things in a small session. So thank you for that. Now, about the bill itself, I also don't like the idea of micromanaging one of our agencies. We shouldn't need to. But if you've read any of the emails, if you've read the documents that have come out, the agency, unfortunately, has played hot potato with taking action with responsibility, and children got hurt because of that. And so what this bill does is it spells out, when it comes to these types of organizations, and with our agency, it spells out exactly what we want you to do. And it spells out, this is how you do it, what we want you to do, our expectations, this is how you do it, and we're going to be paying attention and have you report what you're doing to us so that we can keep an ongoing eye and that we never can say we didn't take action when a child was being hurt. That's something that's absolutely crucial. So I know that the details of how that's played out, Senator Gelsert will go over into later, I assume. But it's very important that we do that. Two of my favorite parts of this bill. One is the idea of the standard of care. And we could talk about this, but when you remove a child from a biological parent, I want there to be a pretty high standard for what it takes to break that bond and separate that child from that family. However, when we have providers taking care of children in a contract with the state of Oregon, then I think that we can increase that standard a heck of a lot higher than what we have for biological families. If we are paying someone to care for a child, then we can have a high standard. And so I appreciate that that is addressed in this and clarifies that. I also like with one of the amendments that I believe will be discussed, the idea of looking into, would it be beneficial for the agency to be accredited? Let's figure out. You know, there are some states in this nation that are pretty good at this stuff. Let's figure out what we're doing on a national level and take a good hard look about getting a national eye on this so that we are consistently meeting good standards. And then one other thing I want to comment before I move on from this is another generalization. Here later this week, you're probably going to hear me talk harshly to DHS about being over budget. I'm not excited about that. There are all kinds of things in the department's budget that I think we can do better as far as spending. So to bring forward a bill that asks for more money, that's tough for me as well. The two positions that we're asking to pay for, could we hold off and wait for us to duke it out over with the overall bill and cut spending in other areas? We could, but the problem is children need that attention now. And so I really hope that we move this bill, we get the extra positions in place to get the oversight that we need right now, to get the licenses we need right now, to protect children right now, so that they're not waiting, and that down the road we continue to have those hard conversations about spending our money better. So I encourage you, please send this on to Ways and Means so we can send it on and keep protecting or begin protecting better Oregon's children. And we'll freely take questions. I could talk for hours on this.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for the good representative?
I just appreciate your coming forward and talking to us this way.
Thank you. And if you have questions later, you know, Senator Gelsert and I have been through this quite a bit, and so I have lots of opinions that she's already covered most of. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think we'll be seeing you again, hopefully, with another bill coming,
yes,
coming this way of yours that
yes,
addresses this area. Thank you so much. All right. So we are in the public hearing. The amendments that we have in front of us today that we're considering are the Dash 3 amendments, the Dash 5 amendments, and the Dash 6 amendments. And I want to quickly tell you what those are before we start bringing the panels up. The Dash 6 amendments are the technical corrections to the bill that we looked at in January. The Dash 5 amendments. And for all of you on the committee, I sent you an engrossed bill on Friday evening. That is what these are, with one major change, which is that there was a lot of concern and confusion around the phrase family foster care as opposed to certified foster care, because most foster care takes place in families. So what you'll see in that Dash 5 amendment is every place in the bill that it talks about a family foster home, it replaces that with Proctor Foster Home. So these are the foster homes that are overseen by the licensed agency, not the foster homes that are certified by the community. And that was a great improvement. The Dash 6 amendment, the Alliance of Children's Programs will talk about more. It's this idea of the Center for Continuous Improvement. It's part of the effort to continue this conversation about how we support our providers to provide the best services that they can, support their professionalism, look at what does it cost to provide these services, and how we can address the issue of safety through capacity. When we don't have enough beds for kids, when we have programs that are closing, it's very hard to hold that bar high and have choices to put kids in the places that are most appropriate to their needs. And this concept is intended to help us have that conversation and begin a peer-driven, provider-driven support system that begins next year. And then the Dash 3 amendment is the concept that Representative Stark just mentioned about having the department bring us information about what it would take for our Department of Human Services to join the states that have become accredited by a national organization. It's another good idea that was brought forward by the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. And I think many of you received emails about those concepts, and those I'm hoping that we'll have the chance to adopt today.
So which ones are the amendments that you would like to, that are in play?
So the Dash 3 amendments, which is the accreditation, mm-hmm. The Dash 5 amendments, which are basically the corrections to the bill, and the Dash 6 amendments, which is the Center for Continuous Improvement. Okay? And with that, I want to, yes,
Senator. Chair, is any of this contemplated in the rebalance?
No, we have spoken directly with the co-chairs, the presiding officers, and right, the governor, so it is anticipated in the budget planning for the session, these two additional
positions.
Separate
from the rebalance itself.
Yes, okay.
Exactly. Madam Chair, thanks. I'm glad that you're changing the name away from Family Care Center. Does the term Proctor Child Care, does that have currency? How did you land on that name?
Senator Dimbrough, that suggestion, that phrase came from Kamala Sugar from the Department of Justice, who's here today, and I believe that it originated from the Department of Human Services, so they can talk about that. And before everyone comes up, I would just like to thank everyone that has worked really hard on this, late at night, on the weekends, really early in the mornings. I had an email from Belissa this morning at like 3:32 a.m. She has turned things around. Kamala from the Department of Justice has just been extraordinary working with all of the different agencies. Christine from the Oregon Youth Authority. We've heard from the Public Defender's Office. We've had a bunch of attorneys at Youth Rights and Justice, all of the providers, Children's First, CASA. So many people have been reading and responding, and Belissa has been accommodating those changes as they've come. So thank you to everybody that's worked on these things. And with that, I'd like to invite Belissa up just to go back over some pieces of the bill. We did go through the bill section by section 2 weeks ago. Do we want to go all the way back through it again, or can we land on the places where you have questions and we need clarification?
Let's deal with the amendments.
Great. Belissa, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Melissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I drafted the bill. So you want me to go back over the bill?
No, I think let's hit the pieces of the amendment, and I can kind of lead you through those pieces. Is that what you're asking for, Senator Cruz?
We've been through the bill. We just need to know the impacts of the amendments, what the real changes are, and I think we'll be good at that point.
So can I, do you want to first talk about the OIA amendments?
Yeah, which one is that?
They're all, these are all encompassed in the Dash 5. This is, or yeah, it's everything that's within the Dash 5.
Dash 5.
Yeah.
So the Oregon Youth Authority was concerned that they also have contracts with what used to be called Family Foster Homes, and is now Proctor Foster Homes. And they also have youth that are committed into their custody, not just the Department of Human Services. And so there are many amendments, changes in the Dash 5 amendments that add in references to the Oregon Youth Authority in circumstances where they have a contract with a child caring agency, and also there are many changes that would require notification of the Oregon Youth Authority when, for example, there has been a substantiated finding of abuse, or a finding that a child caring agency is not in conformance with rules of operation. So that in general is a lot of the changes with reference to the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'm sure they might want to talk about that a little bit more.
And we'll bring up each of those groups. I think there were a couple of other issues that we had promised people that we would put on the record, and one of them had to do with the scope of the bill and whether or not we are causing anybody new to be licensed by the Office of Licensing at the Department of Human Services that is not required to be licensed right now.
I did not draft the bill to do that. What I drafted the bill to do was to clarify what a child caring agency is, and to bring in, I did bring in to the definition of child caring agency a number of other named entities that currently exist in statute that are currently licensed, certified, or authorized by the Department of Human Services in that ORS Chapter 418. And it brings them all together under the umbrella of child caring agencies. And they all have some kind of function that involves providing care or services to children. And so instead of having them all be separate in ORS Chapter 418, they are now under the umbrella of being a child caring agency that is subject to the requirements of Senate Bill 1515, or would be.
So, for instance, the provisions of the bill would not apply to an organization that may provide some services to children but isn't licensed by DHS, is not required to be licensed.
That would not fit into the definition of a child caring agency, no.
Thank you. And then the next piece on the list was the definition of child and where kind of the 18 to 21 and what the breadth of that application is.
Right. And I know there was some concern about raising the age of definition of a child from being an individual under 18, unmarried individual under 18, to being an unmarried individual under 21. And I'm open to hearing what those concerns are and how they might affect things, but I really do not have concerns about that because there are many references in the statutes that deal with juveniles and dependency cases that define child to be, child or juvenile, to be a person who is under the age of 21. And I have a number of examples that I'd be happy to share with you if you would like, but it seems to me that raising it to that age limit would not have an an effect on the duties and responsibilities of the department. In fact, under the statutes 418.001 in particular, that defines the duties and responsibilities of the department in general, it talks about child being an individual under 21, and that child welfare services involve such individuals under 21.
And then I think the last question that was specific for you that I've heard from folks out there is there anything in the bill that would lessen confidentiality requirements for personally identifiable information related to children?
Right. Senator Gelzer, members of the committee, the bill has a number of areas in it where when confidential information is implicated, it references that either the information is to be redacted or not to be disclosed. And I tried to be very careful in making sure that any information that would go to the public in connection with investigations or reports had that kind of qualifying language to it. The other thing I would like to point out is that by including the definition of a child under 21 in a child caring agency in 419B005, that makes any compilation of records or reports in connection with an investigation of abuse of such a child confidential under 419B035. And I believe I heard members from or representatives of the department speak to the fact that that statute was drafted in particular to address the federal confidentiality requirements.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Belissa about the technical aspects of the bill? No. Anybody want to move their head if I missed something I was supposed to ask? I don't see anybody waiting. Thank you so very much. And to Pubs, too, down there.
Definitely.
Remarkable. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next, I'd like to invite Danny Ledesma and Clyde Psyche, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelzer, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Danny Ledesma. I serve as Governor Brown's Housing and Human Services Policy Advisor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 1515. Governor Brown supports this bill because she's deeply committed to ensuring the safety of vulnerable children in our foster care system. We want to applaud Senator Gelzer's comprehensive, almost Herculean effort and approach to crafting this bill. This bill supports our collective duty to become accountable to keeping kids safe and ensuring that they are in caring environments that allow them to thrive. On any given day in Oregon, over 7,500 children are in care. These children in foster care are in the custody of the state, and our direct responsibility is to them. Thank you, Chair Gelzer, for including DHS, DOJ, providers, attorneys, parents, foster youth, and our office as a sounding board, as you crafted and researched this bill. Thank you for recognizing the complexity of our child welfare system and for taking swift action with a pathway for continuous improvement over the next coming months. Governor Brown shares your serious concerns about the current situation that calls into question Oregon's foster care services and state agency accountability. Immediately after learning of these concerns, she appointed Interim Director Clyde Psyche, who has already made several changes to address the culture and practice at DHS. The governor also called for an independent review of the substitute care system and appointed an external review committee to oversee these efforts. The work of these two entities is underway and will complement this important new legislation. Thank you, Chair Gelzer, for serving on the External Review Committee. We look forward to continuing to working together to improve our system, to address safety, provider capacity, disproportionality, and timeliness to permanency. Thank you.
And many thanks to Governor Brown, who you have worked hard, your office has worked hard, and the governor personally has been on the phone and has worked on this bill as well. And I'm grateful for her very direct attention to these issues. Her commitment to these kids, accountability, and safety couldn't be more clear.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, for the record, Clyde Psyche. I'm the interim director of the Department of Human Services. So when the governor asked me to step into the role of interim director, she made it very clear to me that one of my top priorities was the safety of children in our foster care system. She had serious concerns about some of the incidents that came to light over the past year, and I shared those concerns with her. So after being at the department for the last 2 months, I quickly realized that we have to improve our systems, processes, and also the culture of the agency, and once again make safety our top priority. Safety has been something that we really, for lack of a better term, have not paid as much attention to as we have. And it's my job over the next few months to change that and to really work with the agency to move them forward. The bill that you sponsored, Senate Bill 1515, provides a framework and some tools that will help us achieve the goals that we've set for ourselves around children's safety. The bill also addresses accountability within the department, and it's clear and makes clear that we have a duty and obligation to make sure that our kids are in a safe and healthy environment. I said before to members of the committee that our caseworkers have some of the toughest jobs in state government, and most of them are dedicated and professional group of employees. We also have many caring and competent providers that provide excellent care for children, for our foster children. But that being said, we still have the responsibility to provide the safest environment we can for our foster children, and we have to do better. So finally, I wanted to thank you, Senator Gelser, and members of the committee for the leadership on this issue. Also want to thank my staff who spent many hours working with you on this bill. Kamala Sugar from the Department of Justice and Belissa Sidlek from Legislative Council, who I also have received emails from them late into the night or early in the morning. And also Janet Ahrens from the Oregon Children's Alliance and all the providers who helped get to where we needed to be on this bill. And with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Clyde. And I'd like to thank you for just how accessible you have been, how accessible your staff has been, and you have allowed them to be just your leadership in helping us access the records that we needed to build this. It's we couldn't have drafted a bill without all of that effort of your managers, your leadership team, and your leadership on that. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Are there questions for Danny or Clyde? Or Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Sarah, Senator. Yes, thank you so much. This is something that I hate to do during a short session, but it's imperative that we do something. I have a couple of questions on the dash threes and dash sixes. With the dash threes that deal with the DHS accreditation, the language is that you will do the reports, but there's nothing that will commit you to actually implementing it. And I'm hoping that in the report you'll have how much it's going to cost us, because I know when we are accredited in hospitals or in clinics, it's a huge, huge task, but I just feel that is so important when we're dealing with kids. So I'm really looking forward to what will come, but I hope that it's going to be something that, at least I think most of us on this committee would like to see happen with DHS, even sure. If it does cost a lot of money. I think in the long run, it's going to be the most important thing for the state. And then for the Center for Continuous Peer Review, I know that the coalitions really wanted to have that. And again, this is a report and a promise And I'm hoping that in your report you'll say when, how much it's going to cost, but then when is it going to be implemented? Because it's nice to have promises and reports, but I would love to have action items. Yeah. And again, I know it's a monetary tax.
So Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Mona Sanderson, I too am very supportive of both those concepts. Have talked to our staff, and we've actually started work on gathering information on what it would cost and what the degree of effort would be for accreditation. That, you know, to be honest with you, the bill is very generous in giving us some time to get that done. But I actually think we'll be able to get back to you sooner than what the deadline is on the bill. The Center for Continuous Improvement, I've had numerous discussions with Janet Ahrens from the Children's Alliance on this, and I'm very supportive, and we will do whatever we need to do to make that work, because I will tell you that what I found so far is that we do have providers who are very well-intentioned and who want to do a good job. And if we can provide the technical assistance, support, training, mentoring, they will make the leap from where they are to be very good and competent providers. And all they need is some support from us. And quite frankly, I think it's our obligation to provide that support.
And just one follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm so worried about the business climate of all of these agencies, and we lost Albertina Kerr in my district.
Yeah.
and I think there's 18 that we have lost over the past year. That number was just, I'm not sure if that's actually accurate. So we need to have better rates for them. We need to have them have the opportunity to improve themselves, but if we're going to be putting a lot more onus on them to produce, we may be losing more sites. And so I am most concerned that when we go forward, we track, okay, are we losing or are we going to gain opportunities to have children being taken care of in new sites?
So Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Mona Sanderson, I share that concern with you. It's not an environment now where we have to place a child. A caseworker can go to a list and say, wow, I have 10 options on where to place that child. Oftentimes, it's a struggle to find placements for a child, especially after hours on weekends. And I think last time I was with the committee, I shared with you that we actually at times have caseworkers who stay with children in the office over the weekend because we have no other options. And so I think as we build our budget for 17-19, this is going to be something we have to pay a lot of attention and have a lot of discussion about. And the requirements of the bill are needed and I think are things that are really going to help us, but we also have to pay attention to the other end of the equation on what support providers are going to need to meet the requirements.
And I think the intention here is that we don't, I think the worst thing that could happen this session would be that we pass a bill like this and everybody moves on and says, we had that problem and we took care of it.
No.
We haven't. This
no.
This is the low-hanging fruit. And the real conversation that we need to have about keeping kids safe is appropriate reimbursement rates for a provider, child care stipends for foster parents, improving foster care rates, figuring out how do we get more people in the system so that we have more choices, more beds, so it's the right fit at the right time for the right kid. Programs like that continuous, the Center for Continuous Improvement, which will be my top priority next session to make sure that we follow through and get that up and running. But this has been a neglected area for a long time. One of the reasons the bill is so long is that some of those statutes are from the 1970s, and foster youth, kids in substitute care, they desperately need our attention. They deserve our attention, and they deserve more than words and regulation. They deserve investment that keeps them safe, and that is the real conversation we need to have in the months ahead so that we can enact that in the budget next year. Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks. Just to follow up, actually, my two colleagues stole my question. So, but, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, I would anticipate that in your next budget you're going to want to do some targeted investments to to make sure that agencies have the they have the capacity to do what needs to be done. And Danny, is it your sense that the governor is supportive of that? I mean, the agency proposes, and then the governor winnows. Would you say this is will be a budgetary area of concentration for her?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Dembro. At this time, I think the governor is still open to all conversations about how to do that. She's spoken in the past about the need to invest in this area, and so I can imagine that she would definitely follow up.
Great. It's very important, I think.
Thank you both very much. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you both. And please give my thanks to the governor. She's a real leader on this issue, and her support, your support, all three of you has been extraordinary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Janet Ahrens and Doug Riggs.
Or not.
Is this an end of time?
No.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. Doug's in another hearing, and so he may be back in time to offer a comment, but if he doesn't, it'll just be briefer period of testimony. And and thank you for all of your comments and questions. That also occurred about 14 minutes off of my three pages here, so we're moving right ahead. Again, I have to be on the bandwagon for Senator Gelser's tremendous amount of work and commitment to build such a complex and comprehensive bill, and to do it in a way that people can track it, follow it, understand what the expectations are and what the opportunities are. So we are very much appreciative of that. Somebody mentioned in here earlier, I think you might have even, Chair, the first comments that the Alliance provided was actually back in October, and then here we are, it's February, and we're looking at the finish line, and we're very happy about that, again, because of the opportunities and because of the need. And you engaged us not very much longer after that, and after 3 months of phone calls and meetings and exchanging information, which, of course, you've been doing with dozens of other people simultaneously. We really appreciated the early engagement and the opportunity for the conversations that we've had in going through the bill and watching it develop. So just wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Thank you.
We're especially pleased, of course, for the recognition of some holistic strategies. So that, of course, there are two obvious pieces to that. One is the bill, the regulatory piece, and calling out people who can't maintain and hold the standards. The other piece is enhancing and building a more robust system, which is part of what you've already talked about. So with the goal there being that people aren't failing or quitting. Mona Sanderson, Senator, you mentioned there are 12 programs that have given back the contracts in the last several months. But one of the data points that came from DHS a couple of weeks ago that I don't know if I mentioned in the last time we were here is that out of all the licensed foster care capacity in the system, 41% is unused because we're struggling to be able to recruit foster parents. So all of the comments that you've made about beefing up the system so that we're using the capacity because we know we have kids who need to be there is much appreciated. The quality, capacity, and safety is that providers are currently operating under around 250 pages of administrative rule. And but even with that, obviously, there have been some really big problems, some people who have failed and need to be out of the system. But the overall record for the majority of providers is good. Out of the 12,000 reports of incidents of potential abuse and neglect that have come into OWAPI in 2014, 1.2 of them were investigated children's providers. Out of the 3,500 kids that were in the system at that time in that report, 18 had founded abuse or neglect. That's a 0.5%. That doesn't mean that there isn't room for, obviously, for improvement in there. That have to that Clyde said, but we have to be better, we do have to be better. And the two concepts, the DASH 6 and the dash 3 that you've already talked about are ways to get better. So trying to see where I can just move on, because so much has already been said that's really, really helpful and so much on target for what we want. So I'm just going to add a couple of reminders from some things that we talked about in October, and Clyde and I have talked about this, and just a little reminder, because it's not in the bill anywhere, that we really do want an evaluation of shelter care. What should it look like? Should it be in the system? What should it do? Should it have a therapeutic component to it? Should it have a cap on the amount of time the kids spend there? Should we be using existing capacity instead of something separate that would be in an environment that's more used to these kids? And also the emergency placements there, which are also named child contracts. The emergency placements are when the Behavioral Rehabilitation Service System was re-RFP'd several years ago, the goal was to cut in half the number of kids, which I believe at that time was around 200 in half, so that you had the right capacity. You're talking about an array of services, Chair, and the right capacity to be able to put kids in. And it looks as if the data and the information that's there indicates that we're still really, really struggling and seeing a lot of kids in emergency placements and not in planful placements, or reducing the number of moves that they have when they come into the system. So I guess the long and the short of it is thank you. Thank you not only to the chair, but also to all the committee members for your patience, for your encouragement, and for your insight. It's much appreciated.
And thank you so much for your engagement. You, when the story first broke and we started talking about this, I think that very first day you were at the office, we've had multiple phone calls. I know we've talked while you've been in Arizona, and so thank you. And I know it's a lot of work to talk to all of your members. You're very diverse members with diverse needs. So thank you for rounding that all up and bringing solutions. And it's kind of fun to see your name on the amendments. It's the first amendment that I'll vote for that has a name, and it has the Alliance of Children's Programs. So nice to create the record of who's coming forward with great ideas to make the system better.
Thank you very much.
Any questions for Janet?
I got one for you, Madam
Chair.
Very, very technical thing. Section 36 of the bill, and also the dash fives, which is definition of abuse. Sub I says involuntary seclusion of a child in care for the convenience of a child caring agency or caretaker, or to discipline the child in care. Would that include something as simple as a timeout?
No.
I just want to make sure on the record that, I mean, timeout is a reasonable thing to do for some kids at some times, and I just want to make sure that's not the seclusion we are talking about here. So.
No, and this comes from the language that is already used. I'm pulling it up. Computers are great, except for they're not as easy as the paper. So, no. And we could have someone from Oahu come over.
No, Madam Chair, I just want it on the record that if a kid's acting out and you put him in a corner for a timeout, that isn't called seclusion. So just technical things that sometimes need to make sure we're clear on. So thank you.
And while we're on that, the other change that's in here that is important is that we added some pieces around appropriate discipline that it does not include age-appropriate discipline that's age-appropriate for the child, including the threat of withholding privileges.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on inspections. I know that that some of the agencies, specifically those that have very few staff, are going to have increased inspections. And if we add CASA and I think there are three groups that are going to do inspections, do they ever combine their inspections so that it's not so onerous on taking time away from kids?
Chair Gelser and Senator Mona Sanderson, there's a bill that Representative Nathanson passed three years ago. Actually, I believe it's 2856, so that would be more than like 4 or 5 years ago, that requests that the state take a look at that kind of consolidation wherever it's efficient or possible. And they have, the state has, and DHS has worked to try and do that. For example, we have BRS contracts in juvenile justice and in child welfare. So can they do them together? Can they do them with licensing at one time? And that has worked well in some of the larger programs. Some of the smaller programs don't have staff capacity to actually be able to find three rooms for three different entities and have a ferry around files and reports and documentation. So they have been responsive to trying to collaborate around that. It is possible that if you're a BRS provider, for example, and you have residential care and you have contracts with OIA and with DHS, that if you had a very serious event in there, you could have law enforcement, you could have Disability Rights Oregon, you could have both your contractors, you could have licensing, you could have OWAPI. So then we have CASA and child attorneys who have much more access. And while that makes perfect sense on the surface, there is an impact for it. And the impact is that it pulls resources and staff away from child care, and in some cases it can be disruptive to treatment services. So again, the balance in there, making sure the target is child safety, but being thoughtful and managing the impact is important to keep in the backs of our minds as well, because that, so that would be my answer.
Yeah. And I just wanted to make a clarification for the record. This doesn't actually increase the inspections or give inspection authority to anyone. What it says is the access to the child. And where this came from is, if you remember the hearings that we were having in the fall, where the caseworkers weren't allowed to go into the door, and we said, where were the CASAs? And now that I've met with some of the CASAs were not allowed inside of the facility. So this talks about being able to access that child. And
so it's not an inspection.
It's not an inspection. It talks about having access to the child. Further questions? Further comments?
We're good. Thank you
all
so
right.
much.
Thank you very, very much. That is a really good lead-in to CASA. How about Linnea Garrett and Carrie Reek, please? Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Gelzer and committee members, we are here to speak in support of Senate Bill 1515 with the proposed amendments. We really appreciate the time.
Start with your name for the record, please. Sorry about that.
I guess I see you in other venues, and so. Hi, I'm Lene Garrett, Executive Director of CASA here in Marion County.
I'm Carrie Reek, Executive Director of CASA Voices for Children in Benton County, as well as the President-elect for the Oregon CASA Network.
So we want to first state that we very much appreciate the work that you have done for this bill, as well as any other agencies, departments, and individuals and committee members that have looked at this bill to ensure its integrity and really the goal of keeping children safe in Oregon. So we really appreciate that. We're here to provide information pertaining to CASA and the role of our volunteers for children that are living in foster care. The roles of the CASA are outlined in Statute 419B.112. They are, it's pretty clear that we are to operate subject to the direction of the court. We are a legal party to the case, and the CASA remains on the case as they are appointed by the judge until the case is dismissed or the judge dismisses the CASA. There's four duties that are specifically outlined in statute for CASAs to provide. And the first one is to investigate all relevant facts and information pertaining to the child. The second is to advocate on behalf of the child and bring forward relevant facts to the court. The third is to facilitate, and that is, again, ensuring that the parties are fulfilling their obligations to the child. That would be the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, the attorneys, and any other person that is involved in the child's case. We're also to monitor the child's case. We're monitoring the court orders to ensure compliance and to bring to the court's attention any change in circumstances that might require a modification of that court order. We are required to adhere to national CASA standards, and we have oversight from the Oregon Volunteers Commission as well as the Oregon CASA Network.
And I'd like to echo Lene's appreciation.
Start with your name for the record.
I'm Carrie Reek with CASA Voices for Children in Benton County. I'd like to echo Lene's appreciation for allowing us to come today. We are the eyes for the child. The courts and the judges often view us as the eyes and ears of the court to ensure that there's appropriate communications between parties, working collaboratively together with providers and legal parties, keeping our eyes on the child. And we're usually the consistent one, the one that is there for the child throughout the entire time they're involved in the foster care system. We're often the only one that has been consistent in their life, and so we've developed a strong relationship with them. We are required to see them at minimum every 30 days, and it is the staff's responsibility to oversee all the advocates, the cases, and to ensure that our requirements are being met and that we are looking out for the safety and well-being of the child. We have high confidentiality standards. We have high oversight by staff as well as who we report to ensure that, you know, there's confidentiality, we're seeing the children, and we're reporting anything that's of any concern. We appreciate the work of all providers and as well as legal parties trying to reunite the family as well as heal the child from any trauma that they have may suffered through their experiences. And we greatly appreciate the work that's been done on this to ensure the safety of very, very vulnerable children who often have suffered extreme trauma. And so thank you, and we support the bill with the proposed amendments.
I have one component to add. The training that CASAs go through is, in this state, near 40 hours initial training. They're required to fulfill 12 hours of ongoing education throughout the year. Our volunteers are screened and have ongoing support from professional program staff. And it seems like there was one more thing. We have worked diligently throughout the state to implement the National CASA curriculum in our training process, so there is consistency and continuity throughout the state in regards to how volunteers are being trained. And we're very proud of that, and we're proud of our volunteers and the good work that they're doing.
Thank you so much. One of the other things I've heard talking to so many people across the state about child welfare issues is how important CASA is, and that we've talked about the investment in provider capacity, the CASA capacity, the child welfare or the child foster care capacity, and also the child welfare worker capacity. I know that Carrie and I have had a lot of conversations about how important it is to really support those caseworkers that are on the front line with strong leadership, supervisors, and mentors that can help them do this incredibly difficult work that Clyde talked about. They're out there every day. I met with about 20 caseworkers last week after hours, and what impressed me was rather than advocating for more time for themselves, for anything that you would think would benefit them individually, their big message was capacity and how are we recruiting, supporting, and retaining foster parents, and the importance of child care, paying for child care for foster parents. So it's such a great team of people that are out there. We've spent time talking about some things that have gone horribly wrong. It would be wrong not to acknowledge the heroic acts that take place every day in this state for some pretty vulnerable kids from volunteers and professionals side by side.
I agree.
Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Are you thinking of a question, Senator Dimbrough?
No. Yes, I guess I am. Thank you. No, it's just, you know, sort of a, you know, I completely agree with the chair's assessment of everyone that's involved, and the CASAs play such an important role here in linking the system to the community, in a sense. And, you know, I'm just, you know, wondering, you know, in a nutshell, what, from your perspective, could we be doing better in terms of enhancing that, you know, that that relationship.
Go ahead.
The relationship from the.
Well, in terms of what CASAs can do to prevent the kinds of problems that have led us to this point.
So there's so many things on that page. to identify of the work that we can do. And I think that one of the benefits of the Oregon CASA network is by allowing a voice for all of us to be heard and collect the information statewide to be able to provide that information. But I think that one of the critical pieces is having the support and the systems in place that really focus on why we're here. And why we're here is usually because of abuse and neglect or children who have suffered such trauma by maybe somebody outside of the family that they need to receive such a high level of service. So I think that really what we need to do is figure out as a system-wide how we can better support and maybe intervene earlier on to reduce the amount of trauma, and that takes a collaborative effort. And I think that anything we do to improve the lives of any child, either preventative or intervention or higher needs, is going to take people working together and understanding that each person has a role, but we have to be collaborative in our approach. And so I don't know if that answered your question, but
yes, it does. And you can see this is kind of a, you know, many, many meter high, thought. I mean, do you have any specific thoughts of how we could do that?
I do. You're asking two people who've been involved with CASA for 15 plus years. So I will just say one, and I think that is bringing people together earlier in the system, not waiting for the level that it takes to get involved in the foster care system, but bringing the same people that are involved currently in earlier to wrap around and support the families in a stronger manner, and be able to work in that collaborative piece a lot earlier on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, I think the work that CASA is doing in coming alongside the child at a time that it's really critical is important, but it's also that work that our volunteers do over time, working with all parties involved and all family members, everybody that's involved in the child's life. Mm-hmm. So that communication work, honestly, has improved immensely in 20 years. I think one of the things for us that we continue to work on is fulfilling the mandate of every child having a CASA on their case. We're serving about 43% of the state's children. So that means there's that many more children who do not have those additional eyes and supports on their in their situation and on their case. So, you know, internally at CASA, we continue to work towards that goal.
Mm-hmm. So then you're suggesting a combination of just creating more CASAs, mm-hmm. You know, getting more capacity into it, but then also changing some protocols so that CASAs are more routinely involved at certain points.
So ideally, if we have CASAs available, we would have them appointed at the shelter hearing as opposed to 2 to 3 or 4 months into a case, sometimes 2 years after children have already been in care. So that would make a significant difference. CASAs are so uniquely positioned to look at all aspects of a case when there's restrictions on other people's time. Caseworkers just don't have the time, and CASAs devote to one case. So that brings a different type of perspective. And the value, again, is the number, but it's demonstrated by the number of children we're able to provide a CASA for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Thank you.
Next, we've got John Devlin and Arthur Towers.
Madam Chair, if mm-hmm. I could, the issue I was talking about before, I get this text. It's very interesting how people can be very helpful.
Yes.
Okay. And it said to be crystal clear on what the intent is, that there should be an addition to that section that would say something like, this does not include age-appropriate discipline that may involve short periods of time out to redirect or calm a child. So we know that that's not supposed to be included. It might be appropriate to actually spell out that that's not included. So just a consideration, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ready. Afternoon. My name is John Devlin. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm also on the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And I've come here this afternoon because I want to emphasize that OTLA has a number of members who work on behalf of abused and neglected children, to be frank, bringing legal claims against the state of Oregon when the worst of the worst cases come up. And we know that's not all the cases. But we strongly support this bill and any efforts to reform the foster care system. The attorneys who do these cases would love to work on other cases. They're all tragedies, and we want to do everything we can to help reform the system. And as I've sat here listening, you know, I think we bring, hopefully, a slightly different perspective. I gave in my written statement an example of one, the trial that I did back in 2011, and it involved a three-week trial, 50 witnesses, hundreds of exhibits, and a jury awarded the full amount requested to this child who'd suffered horrific abuse and neglect at the hands of his foster parents, his older sister. They had settled prior to trial. And in that case, one of the things that struck me was that a senior DHS representative sat through the whole trial as the representative of the agency and actually took the witness stand toward the end and said that the DHS employees had done nothing wrong, everything was fine, this is the best they could do, and the jury rejected it outright in the strongest possible terms. And as I quoted at the end, you know, I was really struck by what the attorney said about the kids not being regular kids, and, you know, basically we do the best we can with what we're given. And I do want to make one little point. I put ellipsis in there. It's not that they said something they weren't supposed to say. There was some reference that wasn't, it would have been confusing. But I hope the point of why I'm here is because the attorneys who do these cases want to help. And we hope that we bring a slightly outside the box perspective, because we're not social service workers, we're not in the system, but the cases that we've worked on, we've deeply investigated, and there are lessons to be learned from those cases. And there's another data point that I mentioned in 2014, where again, in a multi-week trial, one story of a home with two girls was laid out before a jury, and every penny that was asked for was given by a jury. And those are strong data points that when the citizens are being exposed to, again, the worst of the worst, there are many great success stories and good people, and Arthur wanted me to mention that even in my case, I noted that there were 7 calls to the child abuse hotline, some of them coming from other DHS employees, the drivers, the SSAs, you know, who supervised feedings and said, this kid has a bruise, what's going on? They call the hotline, and somehow in the game of telephone that happens, it got lost. So I'm not saying at all that it's hopeless, but we hope that we have information that we can provide to reduce the number of these cases, because every one of them is just heartbreaking for those of us who work on it. And if you've read the news stories, the jurors speak eloquently about how being exposed to it has changed their lives. So whatever help we can offer, I'm just here to say that's what we want to do. And thank you for the work you're doing on these bills.
Thank you so much. And I believe your colleague, Eldon Rosenthal, was appointed by the governor to the External Review Committee, and I've really appreciated the perspective that he has brought. And one of the great ideas that he had was for the committee and the department and the external reviewer to go back and look at those depositions, which is really concrete information about what has happened and resulted in about $30 million of payouts in 5 years.
I looked up last night. It's about since the incidents take place earlier, but since about 2009 in terms of cases, so 6 years, there have been over $30,000 just in what's reported.
$30,000 or $30 million?
$30 million. Okay. Sorry, $30 million of what's been reported in the paper. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And Senator Gelser, I thank you for reading my testimony. I just did want to mention that one of our members is serving on the review group, has added something to the process, I hope. But we just wanted to be here to partner as best we can with legislators engaged in this too, because I feel like we do have an outside perspective to offer that. You know, unfortunately, we only see things at the tail end when it's, you know, just the tragedies have occurred. We do want to step up and offer our assistance where we can. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. And last.
Senator Gelser, let me just announce that someone left, one of the witnesses evidently left their phone up on the witness stand.
Danny? Thanks, Clyde. And last up, we have Aaron Knott. Send her a text. Last up, we have Aaron Knott and Kamala. Do you say sugar? Well, it's so easy. I made it much harder. Is there anybody else that I haven't called that meant to sign up that did not? Good. Okay.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General, and I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General in support of Senate Bill 1515. The Department of Justice wears a lot of hats in this area. We have the appellate responsibilities. We give the advice to the agencies in administrative actions. We have a criminal division, and we have our charitable activities division. So when we first heard about this bill, we came in with what I'm going to call a blizzard of technical fixes, tweaks, and amendments. And the first thing I want to do, like everyone else, is thank Chair Gelser for being extraordinarily accommodating in dealing with what was an incredibly technically complex issue, getting us everything in advance, giving us time to work through everything. We really appreciate that. Just from a legal coherence perspective, it was incredibly helpful. And while we could, I think, go on and on about this bill, there are just a couple points I think we'd like to highlight. The Department of Justice is one of several agencies that has some enforcement power relevant to this area. And, you know, you've heard about our Charitable Activities Division, but they're a good example because the lens that they look through is purely financial, and it doesn't sweep in anything else. And then there are other agencies that are mentioned in this bill that have their own small bit of this larger picture. And this bill does two crucially important things. Number one, I think it recognizes that all of these agencies are sort of in rotation around the center that is DHS. And it, by substantively improving the teeth of the licensing and other divisions, it not only empowers DHS, it empowers every other agency that needs to work together on this. And 1515 takes the additional step of actually making it a requirement, and I think a brilliant one, that these agencies actually consult with one another. If the Department of Justice becomes aware of a problem, we are now affirmatively obligated to make sure that that message is sent and received, and that is meaningful. That is meaningful for us. I also wanted to briefly mention that we are very excited and how the enforcement toolbox for the Department of Human Services has expanded in a very particular way. Right now, everything pretty much rotates around licensing. You know, those are the actions we can take, and this bill expands those remedies meaningfully, gives access to civil penalties under some circumstances, and also gives the ability to restrict admissions, which we think is a crucially important mechanism for sort of making the positive changes we want to make. Sitting to my left is Kamala Sugar. I think you've heard her name about a dozen times. She was the technical expert for multiple agency issues, and we just wanted you to have the opportunity to ask her any questions you had.
And Kamala, I was wondering if you could talk about the solution that you came up with related to the records, how we were going to create the transparency of the records and protect the confidentiality of children for the purpose of review.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kamala Sugar. I work for the Oregon Department of Justice, and I have been honored to work on this bill for a while now. With respect to confidentiality, there are many, as you've heard, federal statutes and regulations that protect the confidentiality of the records involving children who, by no fault of their own, have been abused and neglected. And it's my understanding that the intent of the bill was to create some transparency around abuse that occurs in special child caring agencies where children in foster care are placed, while not exposing the children's records and the individual children to exposure as having been victims of an abuse situation. And so what we were able to do was create a reporting requirement because the federal statute called CAPTA, Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, allows specific reporting to a certain entity for a state legitimate state purpose. And so there will be reporting to you, the legislature, regarding abuse in a pattern situation. I think it's quarterly that we ended up with, Senator Gelser. Yeah. And so that you will receive reports about abuse in various facilities, but it will not include the name or identifying information of any individual child to protect their identity. Did you have other things you wanted to
add? I really appreciated the work. I know you and Belissa both, there was a lot of trying to figure out how to get at the information without running afoul of the federal law. Senator Wyden's office was actually part of this discussion and very helpful as well in looking at if there were changes that they could make. What I like is that we will get the information, and it will be much more descriptive than just a substantiated allegation. Because one of the things that I've learned is that the type of abuse that is substantiated doesn't necessarily tell us what happened with the child. For instance, a substantiated allegation of neglect could be anything from a child was left alone with no food to a child was not supervised and as a result they were sexually assaulted, or it could be the child got one pill instead of two, you know, a medication error in which there was no harm to the child. So what I like about this, as we start to get it as a legislature, we will better understand what are the events that occur under these titles. And I think that will help us better understand, are our abuse definitions correct? Are some of them overreaching? What are some of the errors that we see more often than others? And what does that tell us about how we could improve training and support for folks? I know in the DD system we talked about inappropriate restraint. What did that mean about training we were doing for securing people in their wheelchairs and providing them with appropriate support? So I'm excited to be able to have the information, protect the confidentiality of the kids, and give the legislature the ability to look inside that black box of the substantiated allegations.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, I think also the added benefit is that by being required to compile those records, the agency themselves will be looking more closely at patterns that are occurring in the programs that they license. And that can only have a benefit of improving enforcement.
And I did receive a question from someone that was concerned about the oversight of DHS of the release of those records. Can you talk a little bit about how we can be certain that personally identifiable information won't leak into these reports from the department?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, DHS is required to keep those records confidential, and so the only way that they can release those records is if there's a statute like this bill will create that allows them to release certain limited portions of those records and nothing more.
Questions for this panel?
I do have one, Madam Chair, if you don't mind.
No, please.
Still concerned about the discussion that Senator Cruz had and the question I asked you in whispering in your ear on the involuntary seclusion. I'm concerned because laws like to be clean and clear, and we don't like to have judges delineate what we're thinking about. And this section says involuntary seclusion of a child in care for convenience of a child caring agency or caretaker, or to just discipline the child in care. So if that includes a timeout or doesn't include a timeout, how does the law look at that? Or is it covered somewhere else in the bill that, because I don't have kids and I don't do timeouts. My dogs just have to go to their box. But
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, the definition of abuse that we have in this bill comes from a definition that's used in many other settings, including seniors and people with disabilities, and it isn't a perfect fit for matching up with child abuse. And so I think because there might be some ambiguity here, the fact that there's a record being laid here in the hearing of the intent of the committee, and it sounds to me like both several members of the committee have articulated that is not intended to be included, that will be very helpful in interpretation if we get to the point of looking at legislative history. However, I think also there is a specific added section in one of the amendments about discipline and reasonable discipline. And so I think if it's read together, we should be able to keep that from being the interpretation that it would include a timeout. Reasonable discipline is still reasonable discipline. I think that it is my understanding, and I can't speak to the intent, only the the sponsor and drafters of the bill can, but my understanding is that there is less freedom for a licensed facility that's being funded and licensed by the state providing care to children in care, foster care, to engage in more broad types of discipline than a parent would, that we expect a different standard because these are kids that have already been abused, already been subject to probably inappropriate types of care, and that there is the therapeutic need for them to be treated with the correct model of discipline, the correct model of whatever kind of rehabilitative service they should be provided. Each child is going to present with their own issues. So I don't know, perhaps Chair Gelser can speak more to her intent, but I do understand that the definition would be tough potentially for parents all to comply with, but in this specialized setting, I believe that's what I'm hearing is the intent of the bill.
And I would add, I kind of Googled quickly through our statutes. There are multiple places in both statute and rule where seclusion is defined, particularly in facilities. So the Oregon Health Authority definition and a number of these facilities also have licensing with the Oregon Health Authority. Seclusion is the involuntary confinement of a patient alone in a room or area from which the patient is physically prevented from leaving. We have similar definitions for schools. It's in a locked place where the door is locked. You cannot leave without someone allowing you to do it. One of the reasons that this element is important in the licensed facility, if you go back, I believe it's in the January materials, there's the letter of intent to revoke for youth villages. That actually was one of the substantiated allegations that led to the letter of intent. A child was inappropriately secluded, left alone. She was a suicidal child and then strangled herself. So these are, again, it's this very high level of care. And the OWAPI, we're not talking about child protective services workers that are doing these investigations. It's these investigators that work in these settings that are operating with a whole variety of administrative rules that very clearly describe what seclusion is. In the education administrative rules, it even goes to say seclusion is not timeout. And that is one of the most kind of frequent phrases that's used in discussions about children and other special populations. Seclusion is not timeout. It's involuntary, alone, locked.
Let's put it on the record. Tell them that you don't want a timeout to be.
I do not want a timeout to be considered.
Thank you very much. Now it's really on the record.
Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, I just want to say one additional thing. DHS will need to promulgate rules to interpret these terms, and so we will work with DHS on the promulgation of those rules and define terms that are vague or undefined, and we will do it at the direction of this committee.
Ambiguity is our worst enemy.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. I want to go back to my earlier question about the term proctor, foster care, and I guess you were the one who suggested that term, and just wondering what its currency is, you know, as a term of art within this field.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Denbrough, proctor, foster home term is used by Oregon Youth Authority to define the same exact type of facility, which is a facility that is sub-licensed by an agency that's licensed by the agency. So let me be more clear. DHS is going to license an entity, one of these child-caring agencies, and then they will sub-license or certify foster homes. And that currently is happening in many, many situations. It was getting confusing when we were using the term family foster home, and so we decided to make it consistent with the term that's already used by the Oregon Youth Authority to define the same type of home. Mm-hmm. Does that answer the question?
It does. My only concern would be that it carries some negative connotations if it is generally associated with young people who are offenders or have had an experience like that.
Chair Gelser,
that would be my only concern.
I'm not aware of a negative connotation. However, there may be one.
And I know when I worked for SPD, we developed Proctor Care homes in the disability community. So I've heard them in a variety of settings that are not just correctional.
Great, thank you.
Are there other questions for the committee? Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 1515? Yes,
thank you.
Children's First. Welcome.
So for the record, my name is Lisa McMahon, and I'm the director of Oregon Foster Youth Connection. And I do not have testimony prepared. I did not bring any youth members today, but couldn't help myself but to say thank you. The youth that I've been talking to were amazed that a 19-year-old might not, we were not mandated to report abuse against a 19-year-old. And they were very shocked by that. And a lot of things that you've brought up, they were really impressed, and I just wanted to say thank you on their behalf. So that's all.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the youth and the foster youth, the former foster youth who are now adults, but the participation on the governor's external advisory committee, it's so critical to have the voices of the people that this is really all about. And at the end, this is about the youth. The rest of it is the how, but the what is always the kids. Anybody else? All right, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1515, and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1515. Vice Chair Olson.
Amendments first, right?
Yes.
Chair Gilser, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated February 2nd, 2016, the -5 amendments dated February 2nd, 2016, and the -6 amendments dated February 3rd, 2016.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated February 2nd, 2016, the -5 amendments dated February 2nd, 2016, and the -6 amendments dated February 3rd, 2016. Is there any discussion of the amendments? Seeing none, is there any objection of the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilser, I move Senate Bill 1515 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 1515 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just if in all due caution there are some tweaky little things like we've talked about here that need to happen there, I hope that you will carry those words down there. That sort of modification is totally appropriate in that Ways and Means Committee.
Any other further discussion?
Now, Madam Chair, I'd just like to thank you for your due diligence on this bill. It reflects a real concern for foster kids, and you are their champion.
Thank you. It has a relating clause. Are you okay with that? Or a relating clause, an emergency clause.
No. Well, this is an emergency, yes. This is a good one.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Thank you all very much for working on this. I know it's been an extraordinary amount of material. And for everybody, I can't count the number of people that have worked really hard and given up weekends and evenings and Thanksgiving weekend time to work on these things, vacation time, on a ski trip, Kamala, and Melissa and Legislative Council and PUBS. This is so many people working really hard, and I hope the message that comes out of that is that there are a lot of people working together to make things better for kids, and that we all share that that focus on quality services, supporting our quality providers, and a thanks to those that are caring for our kids every day. So with
Madam Chair, just a comment you made earlier. I am totally opposed to emergency clauses except for those bills in which I'm not.
Very good. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Maria, could you please call the roll?
Well.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Aye. The motion passes. It heads to Ways and Means. It's 2:30. We're done early. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1515. Thank you all very much. Monday, we are back to housing and land use again. So we should expect a full room and a lively discussion. So please come at 1 o'clock.
I had some folks in today, and we.
Come at 1 o'clock.
I had some folks.